Central Time, I'm Judith Sears Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the Wisconsin Supreme Court is reviewing whether the state court system should be subject to Wisconsin's open records law. Our guest explains why he says the courts need to remain transparent. First, we take a look at a different state Supreme Court story. In a 5-2 ruling today, the court said police can draw blood from an unconscious person they believe was driving drunk. The case goes back to 2013 when a Sheboygan man named Gerald Mitchell was arrested for drunk driving. He later passed out. When police informed him he could refuse to have his blood drawn, he was still unconscious, so the officer directed hospital staff to take the sample. Mitchell argued his constitutional rights were violated, but the court said drivers automatically consent to a blood test when they get behind the wheel, and when you drive to a point you lose consciousness, you forfeit the chance to withdraw your consent. Marcus Berghahn studies this morning's decision. He's an attorney with the Madison Law Firm of Hurley Burrish. He's also an adjunct professor at the University of Wisconsin Law School, where he teaches a seminar on constitutional and criminal law. Marcus, welcome to Central Time.
Good afternoon.
So it sounds like if you want to refuse to have your blood drawn, you should make sure that you're awake and responsive. Is that kind of the takeaway here?
Absolutely.
And so what does that mean? How often does it happen that someone would be conscious enough to be driving, but then be unconscious and not able to give consent?
This is an outlier of a situation, but it is a small, it's a case that happens often enough. If we go back a few years, this case derives from a holding from the U.S. Supreme Court that said you had to have a warrant in order to obtain blood in an OWI investigation. The police have an interest in obtaining the blood as evidence of a crime. And for many years, the courts had held, or Wisconsin courts had held, that the dissipation of alcohol, the natural dissipation of alcohol, was an exigent circumstance.
So yeah, I was going to say, this isn't a case where, oh, we want to get into this apartment, the stuff will still be in there. This is your body's processing the alcohol as it's going on.
As time progresses, the alcohol content reduces and perhaps is eliminated completely by the time that the police obtain the blood. For many years, Wisconsin Supreme Court held that, no, that dissipation by itself was an emergency circumstance that was an exception to the Fourth Amendment's warrant requirement. But in 2013, the U.S. Supreme Court said that alone can't be the rule. There have to be other facts. And so in a few decisions following that 2013 case called McNeely, our Wisconsin courts have tried to carve out where are the exceptions, where are the limits. Here, the limit on consent is if you're unconscious, then you are deemed to have given consent. Indeed, every Wisconsin driver, when you take to the road, if you are licensed, you are deemed to have given consent to have the police draw your blood.
And are there other aspects of implied consent besides blood draws that come into play in, say, a criminal arrest or a criminal stop?
Well, consent is one of the major exceptions to the warrant requirement. It's a sort of a, it doesn't happen often. In most cases, people will agree to give their blood to the police, or the police will obtain a warrant. We do that now after the McNeely decision from 2013 by telephone. The police in their police cars, using their computers that are in the squad, can apply to a judge telephonically and obtain a search warrant to get the blood. And so that happens in many cases. And so this is the outlier of a case, but an exception that's important, where the question had always been, well, what do we do with these people where you can't seem to voluntarily consent or do anything to protect your constitutional rights?
It's interesting. They're saying that by getting on the road and being behind the wheel of a vehicle, you are consenting to this. But is that, that seems like something that a lot of people certainly wouldn't know and aren't going to know going forward.
Indeed. Very few people understand this concept. And I don't think that when you get your driver's license, that it's a clear point made to you. But it's also one that the legislature says, we assume this, that to be true, that everyone knows this, that licensure means consent.
In oral arguments in April, Justice Michael Gableman found the matter to be pretty black and white. Let's take a listen.
Isn't the remedy obvious? Don't sign up for a driver's license. If you don't want to be subject to the laws of implied consent, with it, which every licensed driver in this room is subject to, the remedy is clear from the beginning.
Would you say that that was the general feeling among the five justices who sided with the state on this issue?
based on the expansive writing about how consent applies when you get into a car, I agree with that, with your view on that. It's an important point because giving up constitutional rights usually has to be done with the ability to do so, voluntarily, knowingly, intelligently. And one can't say that necessarily when one is too intoxicated or unconscious, whether due to accident or, in this case, as it was, intoxication.
Justice Anne Walsh Bradley insisted during those oral arguments that police shouldn't have gotten a warrant based on her understanding of the U.S. Supreme Court ruling of 2016. Let's hear what she had to say.
It's true that a blood test, unlike a breath test, may be administered to a person who is unconscious, perhaps as a result of a crash, or who is unable to do what is needed to take a breath test due to profound intoxication. But we have no reason to believe such situations are common in drunk driving arrests. Now, this is the punchline. And when they are, the police may apply for a warrant if needed. And when don't you need a warrant? Well, if there's consent or if there's exigent circumstances.
So that was Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. She and Shirley Abrahamson were the two dissenters in today's decision. Was this what they came back to in the end and why they dissented?
Yes, and they've been consistent over the years on these points of requiring a warrant and not, well, challenging why there could not be a warrant in this case. They're afraid, I think, of the exception swallowing the rule. The courts have always put a great premium on police obtaining a warrant, and therefore, after McNeely, adopting new procedures to obtain telephonic warrants and make it as easy as possible. If we allow a judge to make a determination of probable cause, the constitutional's mandate's been fulfilled. In some places, there may need to be exceptions, but here it allows for an end run, perhaps, as they fear, around the warrant requirement.
We're talking with Marcus Berghahn. He studied this morning's decision handed down by the Wisconsin Supreme Court about police having the ability to take blood samples from an unconscious drunk driver. He's an attorney with the Madison law firm of Hurley Burrish. And Marcus, I'm just in my mind, I'm trying to think. So this decision was made about people who are suspected of probably fairly clearly drunk driving. They're unconscious. They can take a blood sample. Is there concern that this could be extrapolated into other circumstances? Say, I'm trying to think, maybe someone was the victim of an assault and they might have DNA evidence on them of their assailant, but they're unconscious and can't say it's okay to collect that DNA material. Is that possibly coming into this discussion?
It's a great law school scenario.
Maybe I've missed my calling.
You may have. I don't know that will necessarily bear out, in particular because here we're dealing with a statute that authorizes the police to imply consent, and that doesn't exist as to others. It's found in our traffic code. It's unique to OWI cases.
Hmm. And is this partly because this is a public safety issue? This is someone who's on the road who's endangering other drivers and other pedestrians around them, and it's not just limited to them?
Correct. It's seen as a great danger. I mean, look, Wisconsin has hundreds of deaths every year attributed to drunk driving, and we're among have the most cases in the country of operating while intoxicated. So there's a great push and a great desire to end that and to give the police the resources they need.
And so in 2013, there was a somewhat similar case of David Howe riding a motorcycle in Dane County, hit a deer, knocked out, and those tending him said that they smelled alcohol. That case also ended up at the Wisconsin Supreme Court. What are the similarities between the cases and how they turned out?
Well, both Howe and Mitchell dealt with unconscious individuals, unconscious drivers. The Howe's case addressed the other exception to the warrant requirement, which is exigent circumstances. And so we have generally we obtain a warrant, or there's exigent circumstances, or there's consent. Mitchell, today's case, is the consent case. Howe's is the exigent circumstances, where the court already from the U.S. Supreme Court in 2013 said, well, there can be an emergency situation. It just can't be alcohol dissipating in every case. And Howe said, no, this is one of those cases where the dissipation was going to happen so quickly And that had to do with a very technical aspect here. Because of the number of prior offenses he had, his level of intoxication was 0.02 before he was breaking the law, rather than 0.08. So that amount of alcohol would dissipate more rapidly, and they might not be able to get a warrant for certain reasons having to do with the facts in the case.
So that was the special circumstance in that case, was that the threshold for him to be considered intoxicated was so much lower.
Correct.
And so very similar situations, but really testing different parts of the law and these circumstances.
Looking at different exceptions to the warrant requirement.
And as we wrap up, Marcus, with this decision today, are there aspects of the idea of consent that either were not covered with this, or is this raising questions in different circumstances that the court might then need to go back and revisit in another case?
Well, as I read a number of the footnotes in the dissent, I think there is one loose thread that will be pulled on, and that is that at least four justices seem to implicitly suggest that the statutory provision saying if you refuse to give your blood, that it can be drawn, that can be taken against you as a negative inference. Now, it's done implicitly, and so that will probably be a few years down the road, we'll be talking about that.
It's a little bit like taking the fifth, but everybody assumes that that means you did something wrong.
Right. And we have a statute that says you did it wrong if you take the fifth.
Well, Marcus, thank you so much for joining us and explaining this case for us.
Thank you.
Marcus Berghahn is an attorney with the Madison Law Firm of Hurley Burrish and is an adjunct professor at the University of Wisconsin Law School. We talked with him about today's state Supreme Court ruling that says police can draw blood from an unconscious person suspected of drunk driving. Right now, justices at the Wisconsin Supreme Court are taking a look at the state's open records law and figuring out whether it applies to them and the rest of the Wisconsin court system. According to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, this all started last month when conservative talk show host Mark Belling made a records request to get an email address for a Waukesha County judge. He got a response from the director of state courts saying that the Supreme Court plans to decide whether the court system is actually subject to the open records law. The director sent a follow-up letter yesterday saying it would not provide the email address and that the court still has not decided whether the public records law applies to the court system. The statute as written does include, quote, any court of law in the list of entities that are covered by its provisions. This new development comes 3 years after the state legislature used a late-stage budget maneuver to greatly restrict access to lawmaker records. After public outcry, that effort was scrapped. Bill Leaders is the president of the Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council and the managing editor of the Progressive magazine. Bill, welcome back to Central Time.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
So, as an open records advocate, how does all of this sit with you?
Well, what happened was the response that was received by Mark Belling and to his request said that the court had decided to revisit this issue, to decide whether or not the open records law, which applies to everyone else, state and local government, whether the open records law applied to the court system. They've always been a little loosey-goosey about this. They say in response is that, well, you know, the court has never decided whether the law applies to us or not, but here are your records. We're going to give them to you here.
So basically saying we're not required to do this, but we're going to do it.
More that, you know, the issue has just never been determined to any degree of certainty. Which is strange because, as you know, the law says that any court of law is explicitly covered. So the intention of the legislature in drafting the law was to include the court system along with school boards and city councils and everybody else. But they've been a little bit, as I say, indistinct about whether it applies. What happened with Belling, the reply he got was characteristically different because it said the court is now reviewing this matter and will decide whether the law applies to the court system or not. And the response that came yesterday said that the court system has not ruled whether it is subject to the law and it continues to maintain the undecided status. I read that as a distinction from the earlier communication. I read that as they've backed off from this, not going to go forward with it.
And the question seems to be, so this is a law that was put in place by the legislature, but yet the court is saying they're going to decide if it applies to themselves and the rest of the court system.
Yes.
So you would think that that's because of a case in front of them, but that's not the situation. So why are they saying, why do they think that they have the right to decide on this?
Well, the best guess, I mean, they've been very secretive about this. There have been no real communication from the court to members of my group. We've reached out to them a couple times, a couple ways, trying to get some sense of what was happening and on what timeline, whether the public had, whether the public would have any opportunities for input. And it's just been radio silence. But the argument that we presume they may be thinking about would be a separation of powers argument, saying essentially that the legislature can't tell the Supreme Court what to do, that they're separate and co-equal branches of government, and you can't be telling us what we should be doing. That would be fairly audacious, and I think that it would create a significant amount of blowback, but that would be something that they could try.
So this particular incident kind of started with the request of an email address for a judge,
yes,
which doesn't seem top secret, but what kind of information are we talking about that could possibly be asked for in open records requests that the courts might be hesitant to give?
Well, the particular request was actually denied. The court said to Belling, we're not going to give you the email address of a judge because we think it's just too dangerous to be giving out the email addresses of judges. They may be used to give ex parte communications that will bollocks up cases and judges will have to recuse and all this horrible stuff will happen, which is a little bit strange because a lot of judges do make their email addresses known. In most cases, it's pretty easy to figure out what they are just from the form of them. But they denied it on a balancing test grounds. In other words, the court said we're weighing the danger that could come from releasing this information against the presumed good of having access to it, and we're saying you can't have email addresses. Now, that's a smaller matter. If they had said the courts are not subject to the open records law, that would be a big thing. All court communications, internal communications, the communications that they get from legislators or from the public, all of that would be shut down. There'd be no access to it. I did a story a couple of years ago when Justice Rebecca Bradley, who had been appointed by Governor Walker, was running for election. One of these shadowy outside advocacy groups ran a phony issue ad that said, you know, call Rebecca Bradley, tell her what great job she's doing, blah, 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 and gave her Supreme Court phone number as the place where people should call to deliver this message. So I made a records request of Justice Bradley, said, you know, I'd like to hear the responses that you got. Who called you and what did they say? And, you know, I got one of those responses. The court has never decided whether the law applies to it or not, but here you go. And it was really interesting.
Because and so you did receive
I did
those.
Receive it.
Okay.
It was like 60 communications, and more than half of them weren't calling to say what a great job she was doing. The exactly opposite. They were critical calls. Only a very small number were positive. And it was just nice to be able to see what reaction had been generated in response to this commercial that had ran all across the state for days. That type of thing, in the future, they would just say, you know, the law doesn't apply to us. We don't have to tell you what type of calls we're getting, who's contacting us about what.
We're talking with Bill Leaders right now. He's president of the Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council and the managing editor of the Progressive Magazine. We're talking about the Wisconsin Supreme Court being in the process of deciding whether the court system, including itself, is subject to the state's open records laws. So you gave an example, Bill, of asking for those voicemails that were left for justice as a result of an issue ad. We've talked about Belling asking for a judge's email address. Give us an idea of what else might be of importance to the public to have access to that an open records request could guarantee.
Well, I'll tell you another story. A couple of months ago, I learned that an attorney who had previously headed this group of attorneys that received judicial appointments from a particular county was kicked off of that committee after that attorney had filed a complaint against the judge who controlled that process. And so I looked into it, and emails were made available actually to the attorney, but given to me, which showed the internal communications over this. The type of communications that would be covered by this, we're not talking about court records. We're not talking about things that happen in the courtroom or are directly in in response to court cases exclusively. It would also be these type of issues about how do the court employees conduct themselves, the employees that we're paying for through our tax dollars, how do they act? What do they say? Who are they hearing from and how do they respond? Those type of communications would have been in jeopardy.
Often materials that can be requested through a Freedom of Information Act request might have some information redacted to protect privacy or protect sensitive information. Could you see some kind of guidance that would tell the courts that they need to release certain types of information, but with the ability to protect any sensitive information?
Sure. That's what the current law allows. The current law does have a mechanism that if there's a good, if you can come up with a good reason for redacting something or not releasing something, you can do that. And the idea of saying you're exempt from the law just obviates that need. It means we don't have to have a good reason for not giving you a record. We don't have to have any reason for not giving you a record. We're just not covered by the law. So that's the distinction there. Presently, the court can make an argument that's, as it did in this case, that releasing the email addresses of judges was just too dangerous. Mm-hmm. You know, too many bad things could happen if you could very easily find out a judge's email address. And they made that determination. It's subject to challenge. I mean, perhaps it could be challenged successfully. It's hard to say, but They had to come up with a reason. They couldn't just say, the law, you know, we don't care about the law. We're not subject to it.
And briefly, as we wrap up, Bill, what do you think is going to happen?
I think that they backed down. I think that they got the message through the communications that my group had sent and some the article that ran in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and some of the editorials that had started to appear that this would have been a big, bad thing. And as you noted, this is almost exactly the 3-year anniversary when the legislature tried to exempt itself from the open records law. That turned out badly for the legislature, and I think maybe they saw that any attempt to shield court records would draw any enormous backlash, which is good. I'm proud of the people of Wisconsin that we would not let that happen.
Well, Bill, thanks so much for joining us.
Sure, thank you.
Bill Leaders is the president of the Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council. He joined us to talk about the Wisconsin Supreme Court looking at whether they are subject to the open records law. This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. First, we've all been part of a learning environment, whether that be an elementary school classroom, a college lecture hall, or on-the-job training. But what happens when we want to learn something on our own time? Not because it's required of us, but just because we want to. Finding the motivation, the time, and the will to persevere can be a challenge. Ulrich Boser is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and founder of the Learning Center. His latest book is called Learn Better, Mastering the Skills for Success in Life, Business, and School, or How to Become an Expert in Just About Anything. Ulrich, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, a lot of your work focuses on the ways we can learn better in the classroom or on the job, but how can we take that and transfer it to learning a new skill or a new hobby just because we want to?
Look, we have to acknowledge that learning is often hard. Think about learning to ride the bicycle, which many of us did when we were younger. It included skinning our knees, falling down, hurting ourselves, and that type of struggle, that type of challenge is inherent to any type of learning, which is, doesn't matter if we're knitting or trying to get better at horseback riding. We have to admit that, you know, learning is just going to take a little bit of hard work.
And I'm guessing that there are actually some pretty big benefits to learning something because we want to, not because we have to. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. When we are motivated to learn, we're going to learn far more effectively. We're going to deal a lot better with those inevitable setbacks. The way that we talk to ourselves, you know, when we're learning something, I don't know if you have this experience, but I hear it so many from so many others. We talk to ourselves, oh, you know, I am really good at this, or, oh, I knew I was going to fail at this. And when we're motivated and have that sense of, yeah, I'm going to dig in, I really love this, we have much better self-talk. We see learning as this process instead of a sort of test that confirms, oh, we were always bad at this, or, oh, we were always good at this.
Well, and it can be really hard, I think, because a lot of times those messages and those voices are from when we were much younger and maybe much less sure of ourselves. And we've carried carried that along. Oh, I'm really bad at anything physical. I'm just a klutz. Or, you know, oh, I'm not creative at all. I'd never be able to learn to knit, or I'm never going to be able to learn a language because I did really badly in, you know, high school French or something. How do we get past those messages, whether they're from us ourselves or things that we've internalized over the years?
You make a great point. These messages come from when we were kids, and they depend on whether or not we heard them maybe from a kindergarten teacher or our parents. The first thing I would note is that they're normal. Many, many adults engage in this type of self-talk, and we have to treat that self-talk as a normal process in terms of learning. The second aspect is that when we're talking to ourselves, treating learning as this process, that it is not this test of a fixed ability, but really something that it is inevitable that we're going to struggle, that learning is this process where at the very beginning, we're going to make big mistakes, and they're going to be painful mistakes, and that our end goal with lots and lots of practice, with lots of skin knees, is ultimately to become an expert. Another interesting aspect of this type of self-talk is that it is more effective if we talk to ourselves with authority. I love this detail, but you said at the top of the show, my name is Ulrich Boser. If I talk to myself in the third person, I actually am more likely to follow through with that advice. So if I was struggling with knitting, I would say, Mr. Boser, you really got to keep at it. You're going to have a hard time with this knitting, but if you keep at it, you're going to do a lot better.
Wow. I'll try that. Not on the air, but maybe I'll try that at home. I think that it can be really hard to start, but I think part of what you said there, Ulrich, is, you know, we think of it as like, we're going to start this, we're going to learn how to do it, hopefully, and then we're going to be experts. But is that the point, or is the point getting there? Does it matter if we ever get really good at something? Can we just do it and enjoy it?
Yeah. I think that's an important point. You know, should we always be sort of inherently motivated? Look, there are going to be some things out there in life, like Excel pivot tables, where we might not just wake up in the morning and be thrilled about the ins and outs of Excel. When we come across those types of challenges, often they come related to work, but they might be, you know, something else as well. Maybe you want to become a better public speaker because your child is getting married. What's important for people to see is, one, have a sense of agency, that they're controlling it, you know, a sense that they're really in control. And two, really walk through, you know, why it's meaningful for them, why they specifically want to learn it. And so pay it less attention to what other people are saying. You know, this is really important. Instead, find your own meaning, and it can be helpful if you just write it down. So that's really important for those things like Excel or public speaking or these types of things that we just have to get better at because we want to succeed at it. But in the end, that type of deep type of pleasure that people find in their hobbies is going to be the type of learning, the type of engagement that really is going to keep people learning for years, decades, keeps people fully engaged.
We're talking with Ulrich Boser right now. He's senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, founder of the Learning Center, and his latest book is called Learn Better. We're talking about learning throughout the life cycle and why it's a good idea to take on something new every once in a while. And Ulrich, so here we are, we're thinking, all right, you know, maybe I want to try something new. Is there a good process to go through to decide what to try? Because, you know, we're not going to live forever. Our free time is probably limited by work and other obligations. Is there a way to choose kind of to discern the right thing for us to try to find something that's going to be really rewarding?
That process of choosing something is going to be very individual. People have to find the thing that's going to engage them. I think what is important when we try out new things is to really stretch ourselves, to challenge ourselves in new ways. This is part of the benefit of learning, that you acquire a new skill that you can apply in new ways. So if you're a little bit more sedentary, you know, try and think about learning to dance. If you often have your nose in a book. Try and think about something that is going to challenge you in new ways. What's important when you challenge yourself in new ways, though, is to make sure you have reasonable expectations and set goals that are very process oriented. So instead of, oh, I'm going to become, you know, great at the tango, instead say, each Tuesday, I'm going to spend an hour practicing the tango. And especially if you're in the early stages of the learning process, make sure you have someone, a friend or a teacher who's encouraging you, because that can be really key. But make sure you have reasonable expectations or you have this experience. I don't know if it happens to you, but it happens to me and many people that I hear to. You start something and then, you know, within a few weeks, you're like, ah, that's too hard, and give up. So those reasonable expectations serve as a type of protection against that.
Well, and there's something built in there, too, in your example of learning to tango. I'm guessing that also means having someone to tango with. Is there something to be said for trying to learn something new along with someone, or as a new learner, kind of joining some kind of community that will support your efforts, maybe, you know, give you aspirational goals because you see someone who's a little better at whatever you're doing, too?
You see someone who's better than you, and usually in these types of communities, you can also find people who are really good at explaining examples. So when we want to learn something from someone else, it's not enough to find an expert. You want to find someone who can explain it well. That second aspect of community is that we're just social beings. We're a lot like bees and ants. And so when we're with other people, when we see other people struggling, when we, you know, are sitting on the couch on a Thursday night being like, oh, I really don't want to go to dance class or chess class or really, you know, hone my math skills, you know, having other people around us who text us and say, you know, let's go, being in a classroom where you feel like you trust the other people, where there's a nice sense of camaraderie and people are really cheering each other on, that's going to keep us going in those tough times.
It seems, too, that when we decide on what we want to try that's new, what we want to learn that's new, that can use very different types of learning. I mean, I'm thinking of, you know, if you want to learn woodworking, that's a very tactile, artistic form. Whereas if you want to, you know, if you really want to learn those Excel spreadsheets, that's a different part of your brain, too, or a language or music or, like you said, you know, starting to tango. Is there a way to kind of tailor the type of learning that it would involve to the rest of our lives and maybe to our personalities?
When I think about this, you know, question, and it's really an important one, you know, how can we personalize this? One thing that's important to reflect on is that just doing something doesn't make us get better at that topic. So someone might be doing a lot of woodworking and not actually get better at it. For me, the example myself is driving. Gosh, I may have clocked 100,000 miles since I was 17, and I still have a hard time parallel parking. I still get a little nervous when it snows. Curves make me uneasy. And the key point here is that simply doing something is not the same thing as getting better at it. And so when you think about this question of personalizing your learning, you know, there are going to be a lot of aspects in our own lives, whether it's, you know, woodworking or something else, where we just need an instructor, we need feedback. I think of my own life in handwriting. My handwriting hasn't even gotten better. It's actually gotten worse since I was in elementary school. So what are the ways when it comes to things that we're interested in, how can we get that type of feedback that we know is going to help us get better at driving or woodworking or even penmanship?
So really, there's a difference between trying new things and learning new things, because learning new things really does imply kind of a forward motion.
When it comes to learning, just doing something again and again and again doesn't make us better. Lots of people play tennis day in and day out, and they won't get better. So you described it as a forward motion. I think that's a great way to think about it. I'd add a few more things. One, it's a forward motion because we need that struggle that's really important to learning. We need feedback. One of the reasons that I haven't gotten better as a driver is that despite the fact that my wife does weigh in on occasion on my driving skills, I don't get feedback from a real expert who says, hey, think a little bit more about that curve, or have you tapped on the brakes twice? Have you thought about that enough? Instead, I drive and I think about work, I think about my kids, and I don't really engage. So it's that forward momentum, that struggle, that challenge that makes us do new things, but also feedback, whether it's from a peer or even just self-reflecting a little bit more on what we're doing, or instructors of some type who can say, hey, you know, you should think a little bit more about this, or have you ever thought a little bit about improving on this aspect?
We're talking with Ulrich Boser. He's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and author of the book Learn Better. We're talking about the value of learning new things and how we can make time for it in our lives. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you currently working on learning something new in your life? What's something you've been meaning to try but haven't quite gotten around to it? And is there something you learned when you were younger that has proven worthwhile over the years? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Right now, we're continuing our conversation with Ulrich Boser, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and author of the book Learn Better. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What's something you've been trying to learn lately? Do you have a learning experience that you'd like to share? Did you enjoy learning that something new right from the start, or did it take a while to appreciate your work? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And Ulrich, that last question I think is interesting. You know, it can be exciting, like, oh, I've always wanted to learn, let's say, to tango. I've always wanted to learn to tango, and you start, and you keep tripping and kicking your partner, and you can't get the beat. That doesn't necessarily seem fun right from the get-go. Is that a fairly common experience when you're really trying to learn something that's very unfamiliar?
It is a very common experience. It is a universal experience. And too often, we come across that experience. We trip over our partner, or we start to try and get better at swimming, and we're just gulping in water. We have to realize that that is just such a normal process of learning. And because we're adults and are good at many of the things, or at least proficient at many of the things that we do on an everyday experience, we forget that that types of frustration, those types of challenges are just simply part of learning something new. And we need to get over those initial learning humps and challenges in order to get better and develop any type of expertise.
Let's go to the phones at 800-642-1234. And Effridge in Madison is up. Hi, Effridge.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What are you trying to learn?
Hey, so for the past year, I've been learning how to speedrun video games.
What does that mean?
It's like taking one of these old 30-year-old NES games and trying to beat it as quickly as possible.
Ah, okay.
And, you know, I really appreciate this topic because I think the stuff that your guest is hitting on is absolutely true and really important for, I think, any skill you learn. The one thing I wanted to add to the conversation was, in my personal experience, when I get to a point where the returns I'm getting on the effort I'm putting in on learning are starting to go down, there's a moment where I need to like recognize that my skill has kind of hit a plateau, and I think acknowledging that and then trying to break into new areas, at least for me, was an important part of the learning process.
Great, thanks for that call, Effridge. So he's doing something really unusual and new for him, but he's kind of hit a plateau. He got pretty good, and then he's kind of stuck there. That can be frustrating. I know I've certainly done that myself. Is there a way to get ourselves over those plateaus where we feel like we're just treading water?
Your caller had a wonderful question. You know, what's interesting to me when I think about the learning process is I wasn't entirely sure what you – exact skill your caller was trying to develop, but we know that there are universals, whether it's getting better at video games, which the caller alluded to, or other practices. And when we hit these types of plateaus, taking a break is really important. What often happens when we're learning is we have this sense of fluency. So if you're, let's say you're getting better at golf, you take the same putt again and again and again. And when you keep on doing it, when you're repetitive in that way, you're not really as focused, you're not really an active learner, and you can have a false sense of confidence. So there's a lot of research on learning. There's been research in basketball, research in higher level algebra that were much better to mix up our learner. So your caller who described the value of taking breaks really made a good decision. Lots of research shows that we should mix up our practice a little bit more. So if you're trying to get better at the piano, don't just play Bach, play some Beethoven, some Mozart, and then go back to the Bach. Mix it up a little bit more. You're going to have a much richer form of understanding, and you'll get better in a far more faster and effective way.
Let's try to fit one more call in. Bill in Westfield is up. Hi, Bill.
Hello there.
Go ahead.
Yes. I spent some time in Los Angeles when I got out of the Marine Corps, and I met a man who shot pool very, very good. He could beat anybody that played pool. Well, I found out that Willie Marconi, who was a very famous pool player, when he was ready to go to a big tournament or play with someone who was very, very good, he hired this man to come and live with him for a couple of weeks, and he shot pool with him because he was better than Willie Marconi. And I learned from all that that if you play pool with someone better than you, you will get better.
Wow. I'm going to stop you there, Bill, just because we're a little short on time. But so that's kind of going back, Ulrich, to what we were talking about earlier, that aspirational kind of model in front of us. If we're doing something along with someone else who's slightly better, it keeps us moving.
Exactly. And at the same time, it underscores another theme. Learning is going to be hard, and so if you want to get better at something, you're going to have to lose. And so when it comes to something like tennis, it's good to play against someone who's a little bit better than you, or apparently in pool, you know, you have that person in Los Angeles who's significantly better than you. Playing against them, this form of challenge is a great way to learn.
And Ulrich, you said that, you know, you shouldn't just play Mozart every day on the piano, vary it up, play, you know, maybe even some jazz and some classical and things like that. Is that a better approach than say, oh, I'm going to try to learn French, and I'm going to try to learn pottery, and I'm going to try to start running? Is it better to kind of keep things related?
Yeah, this concept that psychologists called interleaving is a lot more effective when it is related. So pottery and then basketball, you won't show effects. But if you're practicing something, let's say basketball, it's not a good idea to take the same three-pointer again and again and again. Instead, mix up your learning. So take that foul shot, a jump shot, and then that three-pointer. You're going to be a more active learner, and that's really important. And you're also going to get a better sense of subtlety. When we do the same thing over and over again, it's hard for us to see those subtleties when it comes to learning.
And in just about 10 seconds, Ulrich, give us a little encouragement to go out and find something that we want to learn.
It is such a wonderful experience to learn something new, so you should not hesitate to do it, but make sure that you're focused on process. Make sure you acknowledge that it's going to be hard and you're going to struggle, but in the end, it's going to be worth it.
Ulrich, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Ulrich Boser. He's senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, the author of the book Learn Better. And he joined us to talk about how to make time to learn new things in our day-to-day lives. He says, pick a thing, start it, go through the process, and maybe someday you'll just be an expert. A few months ago, we talked about an effort to bring public art, especially by Wisconsin artists, to the new Milwaukee Bucks Stadium. Well, you can start enjoying some embellishments in the streets around the new stadium in the form of 15 custom-painted fire hydrants. The Bucks and the City of Milwaukee teamed up for the project, and their regular hydrant painter gets to implement the designs. All 15 are different, but they all feature the Bucks logo and different team phrases like "Fear the Deer." The first five were unveiled yesterday, with more to come. If you get a picture of one, tweet it to us at Central Time WPR. We'd love to see what they look like. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR. And then a social work researcher says there's a lot we can learn from military families about the effects of family separation at the U.S.-Mexico border. And some of that learning is from very different conditions that surround those types of separation. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.